This is the last day of this November 2007 7-day session. We'll take up another koan today. This is from the Blue Cliff Record collection. And it's number 48, Turning Over the Tea Kettle. This is how it goes. When Minister Wang went to Shoke Temple, they were making tea. Rojoza, lifting the kettle to bring it to Myo Sho, happened to overturn it. Seeing this, the minister asked, "What's under the tea stove?" Ro said, "The god of the hearth." The minister said, "If it is the god of the hearth, why has it upset the kettle?" Ro said, "A 1,000 days of government service and only one accident." The minister shook out his sleeves and left the room. Myo Sho said, "Rojoza, you have long eaten the food of Shoke Temple, but still you wander about the countryside gathering charred wood." Ro said, "What about you?" Myo Sho said, "That is where the devil gets the better of you." And then Secho comments, "At the time, I would just have kicked over the tea stove." I have no biographical material on any of these guys. But I do have some material on the context of the tea ceremony. This is reading from a book called Two Zen Classics, Mumon Kan and Hekigan Roku, which is a commentary by Sekida Roshi. And he tells us that these three names, Minister Wang, was governor of the district. Myo Sho was the vice abbot of the temple, and Rojoza was a senior monk. And all of these guys were descended in the same lineage as Toksan, Dershan. So Minister Wang, this governor, goes to this temple where they were making tea. Now this would be a big deal for the governor to come to this tea ceremony. And then we have this senior monk. He would have to have been senior to be assigned the job of pouring tea to the governor. And then the third guy, Myo Sho, was the vice abbot of the temple, even more senior. So we're told that Rojoza spilled the kettle. The tea ceremony, we're told by Sekida Roshi, the tea ceremony was in honor of the governor. And Rojoza, it was his job to go get the tea kettle. It says here, as was the Chinese custom, they would have been sitting on chairs or stools, and perhaps the kettle had to be fetched from the hearth in the corner of the room and placed on the table. We get a pretty good idea of this this ceremony in China from the what we're told here about the Japanese tea ceremony. At the Japanese tea ceremony, the host's first consideration is the comfort of the guest. And the guest, in turn, is supposed to be very attentive to his host, so that together they create this very harmonious atmosphere. Sekide Rosha writes here, their concentration is such that even the slightest mishap is rare. If by any chance a minor accident happens, it is dealt with quietly and may even enhance the composed spirit in which the ceremony is conducted. Everything is done with seeming nonchalance, but in reality with collected serenity. And this Chinese tea ceremony was performed in the same spirit, though there were differences in detail. So, seeing this, the governor, seeing this accident, asked, "What's under the tea stove?" Now, more background here, stuff most of us would never have known. According to ancient folklore, there were gods or spirits in many parts of the house, in the kitchen, the hearth, the fireplace, the bathroom, the lavatory, the central pillar of the house, the well, and even the corners of the garden. And these gods were very much revered, and the housewife presented offerings to them. The effect of this was that it caused the people in the house to do things carefully. This question, what's under the tea stove, he says that there's a saying in Zen, watch out under your feet, meaning to maintain your aplomb, your balance, your center. And then this governor asks, what's under the tea stove? Now, what's he really asking there? That's the first point of the koan. And Ro, this monk who had spilled the kettle, said, the god of the hearth. Well, that wasn't enough for the minister. He said, if it's the god of the hearth, why has it upset the kettle? He wasn't going to let him get away with that. And Ro said, 1,000 days of government service and only one accident. Well, anyone can get the spirit of that. Hey, accidents happen. No one's perfect, after all. This is this statement about the 1,000 days of government service is an allusion to another governor who, in his years of service, made only one mistake in his official functions. And after this comment by Rojoza, the governor shook out his sleeves and left the room. And then Myosho, the vice abbot of the temple, steps forward and says, "Rojoza, you have long eaten the food of Shoke Temple, but still you wander about the countryside gathering charred wood." A lot of seeing into koans, especially these kind with the dialogue, is just trusting your intuition. Just not looking too closely at the wording, but getting a sense of what's being said. And I think that everyone here can get a sense of what he's saying. To which Ro said, "What about you?" And what is he really saying when he says, "What about you?" And then Myosho, "That's where the devil gets the better of you." And then Secho comments, "At the time, I would have just kicked over the tea stove." Another point of the koan. With this koan, I always think of an unfortunate experience of my own when I was, I'd been at the center on staff for, I don't know, a couple years maybe, and I got the honor of being in the opening tea ceremony of Sesshin, and the added honor of being in the pair that went up the center aisle and served Roshi himself for that opening tea ceremony. And after pouring his tea, then we went down the center aisle, got everyone else, came back up, and the last person whose cup we were to pour was the person right next to him on the tan, next to his individual tan. I had calculated quite well how much tea to pour to each person, but maybe a little too well, because at the end, that last guy, I can still remember, it was Pat Simons. These things get burned into your memory. I tipped the kettle over, he had less than everyone else had gotten, so I tipped it all the way over. And the lid came clattering out onto the floor in front of Doroshi with some tea splashing on the floor. It's a good thing I didn't have a knife, or it would have been harakiri time. There are two aspects to this, just in a practical sense. The first is the making of mistakes. Naturally, we can't avoid ever making mistakes at all, but our mind state is an important factor in that. Our mindfulness. And so, as we heard from Sekide Roshi's talking about the basic elements of the etiquette of the tea ceremony, it's a vehicle for practice, meaning it's a way of refining one's attention, one's mindfulness. And that's why so few mistakes, apparently, are made in these big ceremonies. So, you want to, of course, minimize the mistakes you make. But then, should you make a mistake, that's where your real metal is tested, your kettle metal, and then it's in any situation, of course, any time we make a mistake, how do we respond to that? I think this is a very very important koan in the sense that because we all make mistakes, and it's a extremely important part of Zen training to learn how to respond to our mistakes and to others. The two obvious extremes in responding to a mistake, the first is to be indifferent to it, as in, oh, whatever. Oh, everyone makes mistakes. Big deal. It's not the end of the world. This is not finding the middle way with this. And in fact, it's usually a compensation for the opposite of feeling too bad. It's a defense. One tries to just sweep it under the rug by dismissing it as unimportant. The more common response among people who would be in Zen training, people, conscientious people, would be to get into a tizzy over it, and then to carry it on in one's mind, and on and on and on. We don't have the huge value placed on etiquette here that they have in Japan and China. But what we do have, I think, more than the Chinese and the Japanese generally, is a tendency to be self-judgmental, to be critical, to deploy this inner critical mind, this voice. As Westerners, as especially Americans, this is much more of a characteristic. This characteristic is much stronger among us than it is among the Asians, and so working with that becomes a real challenge, because our tendency for most of us would be to fall into self-denigration or to blame others. In psychology, sometimes it's called externalizing, where you find the blame, the fault, outside of yourself, without taking any responsibility yourself. a person of no less stature than Wei Nung, the sixth patriarch himself, once said this: In abandoning errors, wisdom will inevitably arise, but defending one's defects reveal an ignoble mind. Compare that with what is also even more famously attributed to him, where he said, when others are wrong, I too am responsible. When I am wrong, I alone am to blame. That's a statement that would come from someone of deep understanding, who has no need to place the blame elsewhere, knowing that ultimately it is all oneself, and that it would be a rare situation where one has no responsibility oneself. Usually, these things occur because of a combination of causes and conditions. And yeah, it can be simple enough to find the main source of responsibility, but then there are contributing factors. And someone who has seen into the interdependence of phenomena would not jump to place the blame elsewhere. Even when it's obviously one's own mistake, and it is in this case where it was either a moment of inattention or something happened, a mouse ran across the floor or something, still, the way that this monk, how quick he was to defend himself, does not reflect well on him. So when we make a mistake, let's say in a sesshin, in the kitchen, with one of the instruments, we forget something that was assigned to us, right there is the opportunity to transcend this trap of self and other, and avoid both of these extremes. Neither beating up on oneself, which is there's just no point in that, nor dismissing it as unimportant or trying to externalize the responsibility for it. In traditional Japanese Zen training, the monk in training is tested on this, and sometimes in a very severe way, where even things that were not your responsibility, you would be scolded for, to see how you respond to that. So I heard stories when I was there of being given an instruction, go get a bucket of hot water, and you scurry off. People in Japan are always scurrying. You scurry off, and you get your bucket of warm water, you bring it back, and your supervisor says, "Why'd you bring warm water?" "Well, because you told me to." And then you'd be chewed out for that, just to test you. See if you can get free of the whole matter of right and wrong and blame and so forth. It is liberating to experience this, to be scolded for something. Let's say even if you do deserve it, if it's your own mistake and you get scolded for it, to be able to just let it pass through you. I mean, learning from it, acknowledging, okay, that was careless on my part. This won't happen again. But then letting it go. No teacher wants you to go on chewing it over. A teacher wants you to, or a supervisor wants you to get the point that was a mistake and got to be more mindful in the future, but then drop it right away, drop it. And having to contend with these scoldings is a great way to scour away one's attachment to self and one's attachment to right and wrong. We can find a space, a realm that is beyond right and wrong, even when we're at the receiving end of these kind of mistakes. And that realm is simply to let go of it in the mind, not to go on chewing over the memory of what just happened. And then we're free. We've learned not to do it that way or not to forget and then go on. A quite famous passage by a master speaking of this realm that is beyond right and wrong, goes as follows. Don't be overjoyed at the right, don't be distressed over the wrong. For the ancient masters, things are like flowers and blossoms. Peach blossoms are red, plum blossoms are white, and roses are pink. Though I ask the spring breeze why they are so, it knows nothing. Of course, in our zazen, we learn to let go of our failures because it's happening every few seconds. We keep dropping the practice. That's where we really develop this ability to let go. And we learn the price we pay for clinging to thoughts of our own or others' errors or failures. There's the famous story of Xu Yun. who was the most famous of the Chinese Zen masters of the last century, the 20th century, who came to enlightenment when he was having tea poured and the cup dropped, it broke. And at that moment, his mind awakened. And then we have, at the end there is Secho's comment. At the time, I would just have kicked over the tea stove. Just leaping free of the net of right and wrong, good and bad. My fault, his fault, her fault, their fault. Miles Davis once said, "Don't worry about mistakes. There are none." The other thing is to see so-called mistakes as even themselves not somehow outside of truth. It's not like there's the Dharma, our Buddha nature, and then there are these mistakes that somehow crept in there that we have to get out of there. Everything is it. Even the mistakes. It's the same with people. Even people who fail in whatever ways, even the failure itself is perfect in its own way. It's exactly what needs to happen. We can never exclude anything from the truth. We have this most exalted method of freeing ourselves from the bondage of these notions of right and wrong and good and bad and failure and success and so forth is through the Zazen. T.S. Eliot wrote, "From wrong to wrong, the exasperated spirit proceeds unless restored by that refining fire wherein you must move in measure like a dancer." That refining fire, the forge, the blast furnace of Mu, Zazen, that removes these impurities from the mind, enables us to move through our daily life with grace and buoyancy, not getting bogged down by notions of success and failure, right and wrong, and so forth. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.